Chapter 9, Onward and Upward, Back to Atlanta. There was no question in my mind in 1991 that it was dharma for me to return to Atlanta. The inner impulsion, as if by a strong hand on my shoulder, was the primary mover. In the autumn of that year, I decided to make an exploratory trip to that southern city to see what support remained when the Vedanta Society, founded by Swami Mahasyananda, was no longer active. Long urged by the eagerness of devotees to have a continuing center going once more and a Swami to serve them, I returned in September of 1992, and with their help and support, took an apartment in the suburb of Decatur. Two meeting places were rented, one for the Sunday service and one for the evening class. We coined a new name for the enterprise. The Eternal Quest, I called it, because my earlier experience had shown that Americans, and Atlantans in particular, did not understand and were not familiar with the word Vedanta. We felt we needed an English phrase which would be at least partly equivalent. And so, the Eternal Quest. Our attendance was small but dedicated. On Sundays, we used a professional yoga studio. It was quite new and shiny. There were no chairs. We sat on the floor, some of us with pillows, some against the walls. It was on such a morning that the discourse Onward and Upward was given, a title which, by the way, may aptly describe, perhaps without question mark, the subsequent history of the Eternal Quest. The following is an expanded editing of the original talk. The idea of progress is dear to the heart of everyone, but dearest, it seems, in the heart and mind of Western man, most notably from the time of the Renaissance. The notion that the human race, and one's own society in particular, is ever on the rise, despite appearances, has had a persistent hold on thinkers and their followers. Onward and upward is the minimum expectation. Every day and in every way, we are getting better and better, and that's the most sanguine. Granting now and then that it may be a spiral sort of progress, dipping down before rising again, the meliorists have convinced themselves, and would like to convince us all, that technology, science, or the spread of religion, or some other panacea, or the mere flow of history itself, is carrying us along into a better, brighter future. Truly, we cannot live without hope. Hope supports, energizes, and augments our aspirations. The question is, for what do we dare to hope? Realistically, what meaning can we give to the word progress? In which direction does it lie? Progress with respect to what? Whose advancement is it we are envisaging? And in what time span? Usually we mean the furthering or improvement of society, human relations and circumstances. But if we listen to the words of Swami Vivekananda, we hear that the phrase social progress is an oxymoron. Today, when the teeter-totter of economic health versus political expedience has become obvious, few would quarrel with that judgment. Swamiji also said, "Every machine that saves labor puts more stress upon labor." Machines do not, he said, solve the poverty question either. They simply make men struggle the more. And do we not see it all around us today? A challenging claim. However, this runs against the grain in our age of technology, and you may think it difficult to demonstrate, but let us consider some of the evidence. Middle-class families of three generations tell us that wages have risen, but the standard of living has fallen. There is less home time for nurturing children, for reading, or for exercise. Hours at the computer and other repetitive devices have given us carpal tunnel syndrome. Our technology and medical research has brought us longer lives, often of lower quality. Physical survival is coupled with mental senility. We see among us the walking dead. It appears that if we fix one thing, another goes out of joint. With the length of life continually extended, where is the means for giving extended care? In our drive for comfort and labor saving, we have become more sedentary, losing the health benefits of exercise and regular physical activity. All of this has its mental concomitants. How dependent we are now on monitors, alarms, timers, and the like. The art of memorization is a dying one. Stress and mental disorder have increased so much that counselors themselves are requiring counsel. One of the trustees of a big charity with a dozen years of voluntary youth work behind her has said that social workers are freaking out all over the place because of their own personal problems. Many are in desperate need of help. Most recently, distributors of aid to the poorest in Africa are accused of trading these for sexual favors. Where do the helpers turn for help when personal problems and the pressure of work becomes too great to bear alone? In the old days, one just provided food, warmth, and a bit of companionship. But now, people's needs are far more complex. There was not much strain on helpers when I was young, but today we have become far more conscious of the frailty of our minds. Evidence in education. Let me cite my own experience with a social experiment in India, where young boys from the tribal area of the northeast frontier were in my care. They had been selected for education at a top-notch school in the civilized area. They were bright. They fairly quickly picked up math and composition and conversational language skills in the new medium. They also picked up deceit, cheating, chicanery, and the other social ills of the urban and suburban milieu, which were unknown in their hill communities. Many of us can tell true stories of this kind. Look at the quality of our general level of education. One hears of, quote, exciting new methods, unquote, of teaching math. And yet, students continue to arrive at our higher institutions unable to compute except by machines. Television constantly refines its technology and cheapens its content, with the result that millions of the children drinking it in have to be diagnosed as attention deficient. Admittedly, some applications of technology stimulate and improve mental performance, but trouble saved by gadgets can turn to new troubles when the gadgets reduce our independence and resourcefulness. As one wag has said, progress is the substitution of one nuisance for another. Prices we have paid. If this is not evidence enough, there is much more which we have learned. For example, the titration, as I put it, of the environment. The pollution of our surroundings can be measured almost drop for drop as we exploit resources for our greater comfort and convenience. Just one example may be mentioned which may jog the memory: asbestos. An improvement, so-called, offering great fire protection, but a polluter of the air and the lungs, and it is now being ripped expensively from building after building where we so trustingly installed it. Do you know that the pretty story of the first Thanksgiving at Plymouth with the pilgrims and the native tribes is disputed by Native American historians? Why history? Just the other day, the British government acknowledged that its attempt to reduce the use of tobacco by high taxes has resulted only in a very flourishing smuggling trade, and so on. Take a look at the present conversion of technology from analog to digital. It is faster, more efficient, easier to communicate. And the cost to the whole society? This has not yet been calculated. New compact discs are being developed, which will hold 800 times as much as today's, on a surface no larger than a penny. Easier to lose. Did we, or you, or I, ask for this? On the social scene, higher technology requires more white-collar workers, displacing manual labor. On the one hand, it gives more opportunity for women in the workplace, and on the other, it takes them from the home, the effects of which are known to all: broken families, disadvantaged children, single-parent homes, sexual harassment, and other ills. Let us look at the geopolitical scene. World peace is one of the hopes held by masses of people of goodwill. Yet is it not evident that peace brings its own problems? In the wake of peace in Nicaragua, thousands were left without a source of income. Better than dying and killing, you say. International bodies mandate boundaries to bring peace between quarreling nations, only to stir up racial hatred, communalism, and genocide. Economics? States may recoup the wealth from tobacco companies to cover health care costs, but what will be the lot of the growers of tobacco? When I lived in England in the 70s, I could see from that distance the rabid hatred and dread of people in the United States toward communism. It was not felt in quite that way by people in England and on the continent. Anathema to Americans, the denial of much of what we hold precious. The communist system had, one must admit, its admirable aspects: the de-emphasis of personality and competitiveness, non-possessiveness, an attitude of detachment towards some of the more crass dimensions of human life. These are qualities admired in the culture of India and other parts of the East. They were preached by Mahatma Gandhi. Can we be sure that the territory once known as Yugoslavia Is imbalance better off today than it was in the time of Tito? Swami Vivekananda wrote an essay called The East and the West, which received wide circulation. In that essay, he remarks, "What is the meaning of progress of civilization, which the Europeans boast of so much? The meaning of it is the successful accomplishment of the desired object by the justification of wrong means, that is, by making the end justify the means. It guides and justifies the well-known European ethic, which says, 'Get out from this place, I want to come in and possess it.'" "Stop, stop," you may cry, "enough of negativity." But in fact, Vedanta is not pessimism, it is realism. The way of Vedanta is to affirm our inherent and potential divinity, our capacity to penetrate beyond the pessimistic and optimistic views of life. We see the idea of progress as inevitable and essential to life, that self-assertion and self-effort have a large part to play in our spiritual evolution. Is any social reformer likely to be discouraged by the facts that we have given above? No eager medical student is hampered by knowing that bodies are mortal, subject to constant attrition, prone to new illnesses as soon as the current ones are taken care of. The true fighter will always say, "It is my nature, never mind the odds." Nor are we as Vedantists existentialists. If accused of carrying on a Sisyphus-style activity, spiritual practice which brings no tangible result, we have a reply. Whether the stone stays on the top of the hill or rolls back down, Sisyphus is strengthening his muscles for a future struggle. We too work at changing things, mostly for the change it brings about in ourselves. It is not that objective improvements are impossible so much as that we remind ourselves of the cyclic nature of time. Our sun has a past of 5,000 million years and a future of about the same. Is it not a cop-out that religion in the West has always thanked God, quote, "for our creation, preservation," as the prayer goes, "but not for our dissolution"? Only now, with the evidence of black holes, has the idea of involution been given any consideration at all in the speculative and experimental doctrines of evolution. Other voices. Let the historian Arnold Toynbee speak for us here. Quote, "Technology cannot be enlisted to save us from its consequences. Man needs to reintegrate himself into the nature of which he is, in truth, an integral part. And he can do this only through ecstasy or contemplation, through religion or philosophy." End of quote. The way of ecstasy is illustrated by St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle, the poem in which he expresses his feeling of brotherhood with the rest of nature, which he put into practice in his daily life. The way of contemplation is illustrated by the Hindu conviction that when a being looks inward with his mind's eye and plumbs his self to its depths, he finds that it is in and behind and beyond the phenomenal universe. Such is the vision modern man needs to regain. The oldest voice of all. The focus must shift inward if we are not to regard action as a squirrel's treadmill. It is in the Katha Upanishad that we find this pungent verse. The self-existent one created the senses turned outward. Therefore a person sees what is outside instead of looking within. A certain wise one, senses turned back and desiring immortality, beheld the self within. To the spiritual aspirant, this is the beginning of a long journey to the condition of self-realization, or the experience of truth with a capital T. The very same mentality which the meliorist maintains in his view of the world will be held here, for the time being, by the hopeful aspirant. There will and must be progress, onward and upward. The examples and pronouncements of the spiritually great will loom before us with enticing promise, and we need to act on that. Without the expectation of inner discovery, we may never care to turn our glance there or set foot on that path. This is the essence of St. Paul's faith, hope, and love. We have the divine promise that to take one step in God's direction brings him 10 steps in ours. Even if it takes years, lives, we shall have the patience and perseverance to carry on until we reach the consummation of this adventure. Every great revelation holds this ideal before us. Then do we have to ask, is spiritual progress too an oxymoron? Sitting in the railway yard in a stationary car, we see the trains moving here and there alongside, giving the eye and the mind the impression that we are moving. The notion of progress comes from the constant comparison of our real nature with its wobbly reflections in the impure mind, which we like to call our present condition. But this comparison inspires us to hope and to struggle. We know it is a middle state, a provisional entity which must be, in quotes, outgrown. We recognize direction. We know there are certain criteria by which we can measure, as it were, our progress. Purity, patience, sympathy, self-control, dispassion, generosity, detachment. And as Swami Vivekananda has promised, no matter how far down a person may fall, the time must come when his course turns upward again to complete the cycle. Quoting him, it, progress that is, does not consist in the amount of money in your pocket, or the clothes you wear, or the house you live in, but in the wealth of spiritual thought in your brain. That is what makes for human progress. That is the source of all material and intellectual progress, the motive power behind the enthusiasm that pushes mankind forward. End of quote. We use the ego of aspiration, then, until we lose ourselves in the game. It is not so much a personality change as cultivated by some aspirants who attempt to squeeze themselves into the straitjacket of an ideal personality. We are reminded here to heed Sri Sharada Devi's warning, even to wonder how far you've progressed on the path is a form of vanity. Transcending progress. How and why do we go beyond the concept of progress? The non-dualist will, of course, reply, he whom we seek is the unchanging. what purpose can there be for the soul, pristine and complete as it is and has ever been? Toward what shall it progress? That which is already perfect? Even the seeker must at last be lost in that which was so long sought. The feeling of time, of space, of being the doer, all is diminished for one who is at the brink of realization. The culmination is self-surrender, a non-event which cannot be hurried. Quote, take all thought of growth off of your mind, says Vivekananda, in one of the most sweeping declarations of the Advaitic position. Like the moon, which remains just what it is, though to our perception it waxes and wanes, so the Atman. This is the revelation of the Upanishads. He who has it here has it there. If you do not like this monistic language, there is another way, highly championed by Sri Ramakrishna. Travel along as the Lord's devotee. Be the playmate of the mother in her cosmic drama or lila. When he was in the West, Swamiji was once asked if it were true that the universe is a gymnasium where we exercise our moral muscles. And he shot back, "No, no, we are clowns who have come here to tumble."